Hello, my name is Colonel Ian Lauer. I'm the Commander of Operations Group, the host of Thinking Inside the Box, the Gauntlet podcast for Operations Group here at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, part of our NTC Warrior Chronicles. The Gauntlet drives warfighting by talking to leaders from our joint force, talking about the crucible of ground combat leadership, training, and fighting at the crown jewel of our Army. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Lieutenant Colonel Matt Bailey, Commander of 4th Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment, the Tomahawks of 2-2 Striker Brigade Combat Team, the Lancer Brigade with 7th Infantry Division out of Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And welcome, Matt. How are you today?
Good, sir.
Thank you so much for coming. I know you're just finishing up a rotation. You're just out of the box. You're about day 5 or 6 of regen. So you've had a little bit of time to think about your rotation. You have a little bit of time to think about some of the lessons you learned throughout. I know it's very difficult to kind of contextualize, but what we want to do for kind of the listeners today is talk about, hey, I'm a battalion commander. I'm about to come to the National Training Center, you know, within the next 6 months. And I want to know, you know, what can I be doing now to prepare, really to optimize the experience so that I can learn the most. Have you had any chance to kind of sit down and reflect on your rotation?
We have, sir. We've done a number of ARs afterwards, both at the brigade and the battalion level. We'll do a final one here. We've obviously captured lessons learned at the brigade and the battalion and company level, but let's put it all together for what it is coming out of this that we have short term we can focus on before we deploy for KRF, and then long term for the organization, for the next big thing that we may need to do. What can we not do right now, but what can we do as we get ourselves on the pin and start to get ourselves prepared, you know, over those 9 months, things that we can focus on.
For those who don't know, Matt is a veteran of the desert. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, sir. So infantry officer with a whole bunch of airborne and light experience, and then field grade and 2CR with strikers. And then after that, I actually came here to the National Training Center, spent 24 rotations out here from 19 to 22, did pre, during COVID, and then post-COVID here at the National Training Center, you know, with expeditionary RSOI straight out into the box, saw the old version of going into the Aruba, and then saw it going straight into the desert. So did a year with the live fire team as 02 and 07 a little bit for a while once the 07 retired. And then for 2 years, I spent 1 year as Bronco 02, the Brigade XO trainer, and then the next year as Bronco 03 as a Brigade S3 trainer, kind of following the brigade commander around. Really is an opportunity for me selfishly.
Yeah.
So I pick a brigade commander's mind for, you know, 19 days every month for those rotations.
Any thoughts as you kind of contextualize that experience within your whole career? What did National Training Center provide you? What did you leave here with?
When we talk about what do you do, you know, after your KD positions, captain, major, et cetera, we talk a lot about broadening. This is considered a broadening opportunity. What I've come to realize is it's still tactics, it's still BCT. What it really is, it's a deepening. It's a deepening in our warfighting. It's a PhD in how to warfight, as opposed to experiencing yourself to, you know, the bigger Army and working on a COCOM staff or in a joint assignment. Those are going to open up your eyes to things you don't normally see.
Yeah.
This is going to deepen you in a way that you never thought was possible. Just the opportunity to see how battalions fight, the daily interactions between battalion commanders and their staff and battalion commanders with the brigade staff, brigade commander. And so just the chance to walk away after seeing that 24 times over 3 years, I would argue more than set me up as best it could for battalion command, just to see what that looks like, you know, a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah.
You know, your daily interactions with the COG, you know, who's a post-brigade commander, all the 07s who are post-battalion command commanders. For a field grade coming out of KD, like you kind of have figured it out as a major at that point, kind of. You're like, all right, I know what to do. You're like, man, this would have been really good to do before I was a field grade, because I would have seen all the things that I ended up messing up prior to. Mm-hmm. And so I took it as an opportunity, you know, hoping, you know, to get battalion command and striving for that. And like, hey, if given the opportunity and blessed with that opportunity, this will help me, like, at least have seen good and bad ways to interact, ways to communicate, what reverberates with staff, what does not, what is good guidance, what is unclear guidance. So I would say the most professionally developing assignment that I had in the last 20 years.
That's great. You know, a bit of a, you know, as the COG, we do this as sort of a shameless plug for coming here to the National Training Center. But that's, I mean, that's without bias. That is clearly what everybody says. You come back here. This is where you talk warfighting, where you swim in the warfighting profession, and you really can't do that anywhere else. It's a place where you're among professionals, all at a very high caliber and all just talking about doctrine, talking about how we fight TTPs. And so I appreciate your comments there. Okay, so take me back, Matt. You find out you're coming to the National Training Center. you're on the eve of a train up. What is your approach? You've got this experience that tells you, I've seen successful rotations. I know what they are. Another thing, you know, for the listeners, this is a Striker Brigade combat team. Not real common here at the National Training Center. We do host a few every year, but it's typically ABCTs. So coming here as a striker, what are your thoughts? What is your training approach?
So the first thing I did was brain dump. I've been an OC at the National Training Center. So myself and one of our other battalion commanders, we were both here together. Everybody kind of turned to us, was like, hey, you guys have been at NTC. What do we need to do? And I was like, hey, that was 3 years ago. It's new Op 4. It's new commanders we're fighting against. Doctrine has changed. The equipment that we have has changed. Like, I do not know how to win at the National Training Center, but I do know how not to get lost in the desert.
That's right.
So I know my way around and I understand the terrain. What we really wanted to focus on, kind of going under that lens, for a 2-2 Striker Brigade this year, starting the end of last year into January, February. We fielded the new Crows J Alpha 1 variant, which is, you know, a 50 cal with a mounted javelin off to the side. And then the other half of our combat fleet is the new 30 millimeter Striker. So we had just fielded that, finished that off in February, and then really kind of did an accelerated training glide path just because of that entire divestment process. We didn't have a lot of time. So we went from team level all the way through division FTX with company CalFex in a 6-month period. I wanted to focus on mastering the fundamentals and mastering the basics. I felt I would be comfortable maneuvering companies, felt I knew how to interplay within the brigade's, you know, architecture of how it wanted to fight. But I knew that that only mattered for me as one individual. It would matter nothing for the organization if the squads, the platoons, and the companies did not know how to fight.
Right.
So all of our focus was on that, was focused on how do we make sure our squads and our junior, you know, our E5 squad leaders, you know, that many people I'm sure listening to this also have, the E3, E4 team leaders, like how are they able to understand they're given an intent, they're given a mission. The radios don't work. They get outside of comms range. They're kind of by themselves as a squad in a platoon, but they know what to do. They understand within the left and right limits of what the intent is. And so that was a lot of our focus. For the staff, it was really getting the XO myself, you know, because I kind of view myself as the senior staff trainer. XOs and S3s are fantastic, but a lot of times it's their first time training a staff.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Everything we do as a field grade that you learn at ILE is you in a room with 14 other majors.
That's right.
It's not the same MDMP as a bunch of first lieutenants, captain straight out of the career course, and two staff sergeants as your S6. So it was really focusing them on, hey, how do we rapidly assess enemy and terrain? And then how do we turn that into a course of action that is executable, but also flexible enough? That's one thing that I did know coming from here is no matter what your plan is, it's great. The enemy's going to get a vote and it's all going to change. But how flexible is that plan going to be? So going through so many different iterations of staff training. And so we used every training event that we did as an opportunity to train the staff through the full doctrinal schoolhouse MDMP process so that they had that foundational basis of step 1 through 7. What is it? Okay, when we need to shorten it, what do we shorten it to? Data is fine. It's super great in the beginning. But really, tell me the things that I need to know that drive decisions.
Yeah.
Tell me the things that I need to make a decision on or that's going to have an impact on our operation, as opposed to we can carry 12,000 gallons of fuel. Well, I know that. Thank you so much, S4. But how are we going to get that fuel to the point that it needs to go at the time? And what are our limb factors in regards to where it's coming from, the frequency, how far we plan on attacking while we're transitioning and consolidating and reorganizing? How do we maintain that pace throughout? Was the things that we tried to drive everybody to through the process.
No, Matt, that's great. First off, you talked about innovation. So we've got some new initiatives coming through. You talked about training the fundamentals. And I want to dig into that a little bit about what that means for a Striker Brigade and then talk about staff. One of the challenges I think we see consistently is staff very dogmatic in their approach to the products they produce or to the processes they have. And ultimately, sometimes I think we don't just dial it back and say, hey, why do we exist? You know, that old find your why that Simon Sinek talks about, right? Yeah. Why do you exist? You exist to enable commanders at echelon to make decisions. And sometimes when our approach becomes too dogmatic, our products become too stale and they're not live. They're not feeding real-time decision-making. And so consistently we see a commander standing at a map. They'll sit there and they'll be, I want to know what that enemy force is right there. The PIR will be up and the PIR will say something to the effect of what is the enemy's disposition and composition. Ultimately, it's not enabling a decision by you, I don't think. And I don't know if your experience kind of leads you to the same.
No, you're absolutely right. I think over the last two decades, it's PIR number one and FFIR number one every single time. Like composition, disposition, and loss of a platoon. It's like, okay, we kind of got to get to the brass tacks. And so what was interesting, and I think everyone, you know, that listens to this will go through it at some point. Unfortunately, we had horrible timing in that you'll train the staff to what it is that the outputs you want. And then what happens? Well,
summer transition.
This July, I get a new S2. Right. He's been the S2 for 3 weeks when we come to NTC. Yep. So when we start talking PIR, that the S2 shop kind of understood that the S2 actual was trying to figure himself out. The S3 is brand new. So we're all the planners, and the S4 is a really well-deserving first lieutenant infantryman who's trying to learn logistics, you know, in stride. I think we got better actually as the rotation went on. We weren't as good coming into it as I wanted to be as we had been in the past. In that, what PIR can you provide? What things can we be looking for that confirm or deny assumptions, facts, and realities on the ground? Mm-hmm. Composition disposition is great, but I need you to look in a specific location based off of a size, force, or echelon force we anticipate we're going to encounter so that I can confirm or deny if our plan is fighting the right enemy.
Right.
Hey, is this the enemy's disruption force? Is this their forward security? Is it their unmanned contact zone? Is it their main defensive line in the attack? Is it their fixing force? Is it their exploitation? What is it? Identify those places, sit temp and that event temp, overlap one another so we finally actually truly understand what is it you can tell me as opposed to, you know, your best educated guess. How can we start to confirm things that can now drive decisions? Right now, I can make a decision. If it's outside of the scope of what I can impact, I can go to the brigade commander and be like, hey, this is what we're seeing on the ground. And throughout the rotation, what was great to see having conversations, you know, every day with company commanders on reporting and the importance of reporting, right? We talk about it. The things you tell me also help the S2 and I drive decisions, both internally at the battalion level, but even bigger picture, which I had learned for myself is like, hey, how am I helping the brigade see so that the brigade can go back to, you know, in this scenario, 52 ID, who's pushing them towards certain objectives that are time-based to support the division and the core. Hey, I have a huge part in that as a battalion commander. That coming into it, I was like, yeah, I have to inform the brigade when I'm going left, when I'm going right. No. I have to inform them if I'm going to hit key time, you know, hacks are not just important because I was given a no later than, but because it's driving the adjacent brigade who's the main effort.
That's right.
For the division who's shaping and supporting for the Corps' main effort, which is another division, and how all of that really from the platoon level all the way through the battalion feeds the brigade, which really informs so much higher as we're talking about LISCO.
Yeah.
It was a pretty eye-opening and learning experience for all of us. Definitely got better throughout for sure. I don't think we trained that enough to understand why reporting is so important.
Sure.
It's not just about what you're seeing and how many things you've killed. That's great. But like, what is that element? Are they doing what we thought they were going to do? Have we confirmed or denied anything? Oh my gosh, no, this is not an enemy company. This is an entire battalion right here. That completely changes what this scenario is. And this completely changes what we think we're facing. All right, now I can inform higher, allocates assets, also informs division, informs core. And we've talked LISCO, you know, and divisions being the unit of action is much bigger than just yourself. But what you're doing at your level truly enables, truly informs that 2-3 levels higher in a way that we're taught throughout our careers.
Sure.
But I don't think we're seeing it in reality until now.
And certainly with the division as the primary tactical unit, we're seeing a lot more of a drive to develop, hey, what is the storyline on the outside? Not just the storyline, but there's cause and effect associated with where does 52nd ID expect you to be? The division, they've given you specific requirements and are we able to meet that and why? And
what part of this is so important to you that like you can't just become solely focused on what your company battalion is doing?
And part of that too, you were one of the first rotations here where we've really experimented with open phasing in a very true and real sense, different from what we've done in the past. Open phasing in the past sort of meant a little bit more free play, but still kind of in the battle period paradigm.
So you say battle period focus.
When we made that transition from battle period to open phasing, but we still had this construct of phases really kind of tied to a metal task we were asking you to achieve. Now, in your rotation, we had very much an open phase. We, to the point of you started on D-Day, rolled out, and then you fought without a suspension of battlefield effects throughout the entire period, only moving to periods of transition directed by your brigade commander based on whether he had culminated, whether he had achieved his objective or his end state, and then determined through collaboration with higher headquarters, hey, at this point, I need to conduct consolidation reorganization. So that was a bit of a new innovation for you. It did require that you had to tell your story to the brigade commander and higher. Absolutely, for those listening, potentially coming here in the next few months, I think it's a feature you're going to see. And certainly, you know, as I was a rotational unit, I really loved my SOBI. But
I'm not gonna lie, sir, I miss that that 6 hour like woo-saw moment of like, okay, all right, catch your breath. All right, let's go again.
But it is going after something that I think you can only do here at the National Training Center, which is transition under persistent contact. We have ubiquitous sensors. We all know this. Black Horse certainly understands where we are on the battlefield, what we're doing. And they understand this because they've got the ability to just read us. So when you are in that sort of situation with a persistent contact, what is the challenge? I think the challenge at that point is how do you gain and maintain the initiative? And the initiative always being that thing where you ask yourself, who's reacting to whom at this point? And that was really the approach going into the open phasing, pushing that transition to persistent contact. I want to hit some of the other things you talked about. There's so many gems in there. S2's telling a story. I think we've overcomplicated some of these staff processes, particularly at the battalion level where, you know, you go through, I don't know what the phase of CAPS career course is anymore, but you learn the steps of mission analysis and all this, and you learn the product and the process. Sometimes I think we don't back up and just say the why. And ultimately, if I have an S2 who can just tell me the story of the enemy, just say, he's looking, he's got these three fixing forces and he's looking for an assailable flank here and he's going to think he's found one once he finds one. I think what you're seeing here is an assault force. It seems to be in a position to react anywhere. And hey, we're collecting on here to see if it's got any breaching assets, which would really be an indicator, right? If I have an S2 that can do that for me, that's so much more powerful than somebody who's just reading a kill chart and being Absolutely. Able to update that. And then it kind of goes to, I really appreciate your comments talking about what is the commander's role, particularly in the train up of the staff. What is the commander's role in training the staff? So many times we outsource to our executive officer and we just don't have time. I got to get out there. I got to see this. I got to do this. I liked your approach. I like talking about how do you keep the staff integrated with every action that you're doing, every piece of that train up that you can possibly have the staff integrated in. That's what you want to do. Certainly, that's not an easy lift. That couldn't have been an easy lift for you. There's things happening in installation, garrison, you got HR metrics. They're still Absolutely. Important.
Yep.
So that couldn't have been easy for you. Talk to me a little bit about the fundamentals. So you said training the fundamentals. What does that mean to you as a striker, brigade, combat team, battalion commander? What are the fundamentals? Are they different in some way?
When we talk fundamentals, I had to reframe. 16 months I've been in command now. Took command. I had an idea of where everybody was at. Mm-hmm. It's a false sense of where people are because at that point I've been in the Army 18, 19 years. So I'm defaulting back to my mental model of, oh, I remember as a platoon leader what I knew.
Right.
I know what I knew as a company commander. I knew what I knew as a field grade. Well, when I was a platoon leader, right, I had a platoon sergeant on his third deployment. Right. I had staff sergeants in every squad who mm-hmm. were all about to make E7, who every single day made decisions in PCCs, PCIs that had life or death repercussions.
Sure.
And so those reps that they had when I came in as a platoon leader are reps that some of our junior NCOs and junior officers simply don't have just based off of where we are right now in the Army and, you know, with deployments and, you know, in war, not in war, et cetera. So really what we had to do, Sergeant Major and I, as we sat down and we talked about it, was we had to refocus and like kind of train up like, hey, what are truly PCCs and PCIs? Like yeah. start at the basics. For that young team leader, what does that mean? That's not going up to the soldier and be like, do you have all your stuff? Like, no, there's a checklist, right? The Army, we love our checklists and we also hate our checklists. But what we found is they're necessary. We started there and then it was, how do we get the squad as the center point, the striker brigade, right? The dismounted squad that emerges with javelins, Carl Gustav's AT-4s, you know, more AT systems than any other formation yeah. that you have out there. All right, then as we progress up to the squad level, how do we get a squad to understand how to employ themselves, one, out of the back of a striker, two, out of the striker completely dismounted? But what we did not do well in hindsight is I go back, you know, and I revisit what we could do that we'll do as we restart our training progression with our new folks. How do I incorporate them well with their mounted platform that they have? Striker brigades, we want to be like, hey, I've got my airplane on wheels, my helicopter on wheels, right? I can do what any other formation can do, but I need nobody else to do it.
Right.
I don't need a helicopter to get me to the objective. I have strikers. I don't need somebody to drop me out of an airplane. I can drive there myself, dismount where I need to, and I can attack it as a light formation if I want to. And there's absolutely a time and a place for that based off of terrain, based off of enemy. But the incorporation of that now new mounted asset that we have, that 30 millimeter cannon, that mounted javelin, which is an additional javelin onto firing system on top of the one that every single, you know, squad comes out of the back with, like truly gives you more firepower that you can converge at the time and the place you want to mass on the enemy. So we started doing that more, I think, at the platoon level when we realized, hey, we fielded these things, we really haven't incorporated them much. The space that you get to play with, you'll never be able to replicate till you get out here. That's just an unfortunate, you know, nature of it. But the fundamentals of fire maneuver, how I incorporate my indirect assets, which we have a very robust capability, obviously, in a striker formation with 60s, 81s, two 120s at the company level, 10 120s holistic across the battalion. But then bigger picture, as we start talking fundamentals for platoon leaders and company commanders, is, well, there's also artillery that's out there. There's our UAS systems that we're starting to field. And hey, how do I get those forward to help me also answer those PIR we were talking about prior? So I can report accurately before I actually hit an objective. I know what I'm going up against. But it was really like helping everyone understand, like, what is the basis of, do I have my stuff? How do I check people? Do I know how to maneuver my squad at a time and a place? When do I, as a squad leader, not just worry about myself and my eight other bubbas and bubettes coming out of the back of that thing, but how do I incorporate that 30 mil? It's not just something that I think about after the fact for security. It's an additional maneuver asset that nothing BMP and below can really compare to firepower wise.
Right.
And so it's helping them understand and kind of training them through that process. We started with at the platoon level, going back as we start looking at how do we retrain squads,
right,
and then incorporate them into platoons. Now, how do I also incorporate with the squad, like, when I get out of that striker, I still have that striker. Maybe I don't always need to get out of that striker when I think I do.
Right.
Which is a huge lesson we learned here of when and where do I need to dismount?
Right.
I don't always have to dismount. Sometimes I need to close the distance with that mounted capability to then get my dismounts out, as opposed to always just leading with the dismount. That goes into your risk calculus of what do I think I'm facing? How do I shape it? Obviously, it has the same armament. It's not going to go up against a BMP and take those rounds very well, but I can shape that thing with 155s, 120s, smoke. I can use dispersion. I can use moving at night to get myself to a position of advantage, and I can get those other assets. And now I can maneuver mounted and dismounted to converge on an enemy, both in an open area and from a restricted area that they're not quite prepared for.
Right. I've always said one of the unfortunate things about a replicated battlefield like here at National Training Center is what we can't replicate is the power of suppression. The impact of what it feels like when you've got a support by fire that's laying on a steady amount of fire that's keeping heads down and enabling an assault element to move. And that, you know, it's unfortunate that's one thing we really can't replicate with the lasers. But I really like what you're talking about here. We're talking about fundamentals on one hand, getting a squad out there doing what squads do with a bunch of barrel-chested warriors just out there doing the hard work of infantry work. But then on the other hand, you've almost got a span of control problem because we've enabled you with so many heavy weapons. So integration. And then I like that you talked about the platoon level. That's where you had initially integrated. As you look back on your rotation and some of the things, did you change at all or modify how you employed your 30 millimeter, how you employed the Crow's J? Any changes that you saw or learned?
We definitely did, sir. I was fortunate in that as a field grade, I had the Dragoon, the 2CR field, I was there for that. So I had some experience. Obviously, this is a different weapon system. I was able to fight with 30 millimeters at JMRC as a battalion S3. So I had different scenario, different terrain, et cetera. So I came in with a mental model that was completely blown out of the water once we got to the National Training Center, just because of the expansiveness, the openness, right? We all know it's a desert, but there's so much micro terrain that can be taken advantage of that you don't really get a true appreciation for until you're trying to figure out, okay, that's a big open desert valley.
Right.
I really don't want to drive across that for 12 kilometers into a dug-in enemy that's got T-90s and BMPs. It's not going to be a good day. We definitely started the rotation much more focused on what our mental model was, which was dismounts clear, dismounts bring strikers forward, and then bring all the weapon systems to bear at a certain point. That was fine. they were successful at doing that. But when you start talking about what we were talking about earlier, and that your battalion is a part of a brigade, a division, a corps, that timing may not work out for you. The time that it takes to clear 15 kilometers of mountainous terrain up in the Alpine Valley area may not fall within what the division and corps commander are looking for you to seize, you know, the primary objective that opens locks up for the division and the corps for their main effort. So what we had to transition our mind to was, how do we maintain tempo and speed while also conserving combat power? And so you start talking about, hey, I use smoke to maneuver, right? Which is something I remember hearing Colonel Simmering and Colonel Chalfont back when he was the cog here talk about. And I was like, yeah, smoke to maneuver, roger.
Right.
You know, nobody ever did, because you're just inundated with so many things and you just don't think about it. It's like, I got a tank, I'm good, I can go. What we found is you have to do it, especially as a striker formation. You absolutely must use smoke. Yeah. Especially if you're maneuvering at daytime, but even at nighttime. Smoke works at nighttime. And a lot of people don't realize that or think about it that way, but we changed how and where we found dismount points to be based off of, going back to the S2 conversation, what they were able to tell me about the enemy. Sure. So if they can tell me where the enemy they truly believe are, they can confirm or deny some through PIR, through the brigade, through the MSS that the brigade, you know, was experimenting with. And like, hey, we've been able to spot not everything, but we do know X is here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I can drive some decisions on my part. I can assume some risk, or I can mitigate some risk with different ways that I can do stuff. So we changed how much we moved mounted and where we massed then our dismounts in conjunction with strikers simultaneously to try to give the enemy multiple problem sets right. to have to deal with. All while 120s and 155s are also coming into play at the same time. So truly trying to, going back to the combining arms in the close fight, how do we get all that stuff at the point that we need it to be there so that we can overwhelm the enemy? What is a striker brigade made for? To rapidly move and seize key terrain.
Right.
Well, if I'm not moving rapidly and I'm just clearing terrain, am I really achieving what it is that the brigade and the division need me to do? And I had to change my mindset on that for sure. My thought process was, hey, if I dismount early, it might take longer, but I'm going to show up at the objective with more combat power. Well, that's great, but I can probably show up generally with the same amount of combat power I need to if I just change when we go from movement to maneuver, how I enable, how I buy that risk down by using other assets is something that after our third day, sat down with the company commanders and field grades, was like, hey, we got to change this up. Like, this isn't working out. Here's what I think we need to do. Got their feedback. All right, hey, for this next one, as we're here in COA Dev, let's look at how we're doing this. No, hey, I don't think it's here. We need to move it here. We're going to use this terrain to get us to that point so that now we can get the dismounts out. Then we can assume a little bit of risk by putting the strikers in a little bit less, you know, protective area, but we have that support to buy them the time, you know, with the 4K standoff and the javelins.
That's a great conversation. And you can segue off of that quite a bit, but having that conversation with subordinate leaders so that they understand, because I remember a comment you had made very early in the rotation was, I have company commanders that they're leading with infantry, but they're securing terrain that is really not that important. And so they were burning up your time, your brigade commander's time, by dismounting and being so deliberate and so careful to move up in key terrain. And I remember that was one of your points, was trying to pull them together and kind of spoke to what I loosely kind of refer to as, who has the authority to adjust the brigade's tempo, in essence? Who has that authority? What authorities do you have as a company commander? And I don't know, how did you articulate with your company commanders? What did you kind of settle on as you got to the back end of that rotation where you're like, I need you to understand when I need you to fight as a system in your mounted platform and assume a little bit more risk. And I need you to understand when I need you to deliver infantry onto the OBJ.
It was just that conversation, sir. Again, we fought through, you know, our first, you know, four objectives, I think it was, in the first, you know, kind of 72 hours. And then we realized we were busting time hacks, the implications that it was having. Division was coming down, higher headquarters, all just like I do to the companies. Like, what are you doing? Why are you so slow? Same thing for brigade and division. It was like, okay, all right, roger. Yeah. I'm seeing now what we need to do differently. They don't know. I didn't know. You know, it's no fault of their own.
Well, and you know, I talk about like your mental model coming in. Even as a cog, my mental model was, I would say, very rudimentary in terms of the Striker Brigade combat team. My model was thinking of it in terms of like an air assault. Got your striker, which is a platform that's going to deliver you to an LZ, and then you've got the infantry kind of moving out. What I found is, again, enemy gets a vote. They're going to take time once they've reacted to your presence. And we tried to see the, you know, we have a very free thinking op four here who saw and reacted. And if they had time, they would kind of move to and adjust their posture and make it much more a deliberate defense for you than I anticipated. What I thought in my mind was, hey, just understanding the probable line of contact, dismount the infantry before the probable line of contact. Infantry, you kind of got that external jaw-like of an animal that just kind of is going to chew up on the objective once it gets there. What I found, it's more nuanced than that. What I found is that with the multiple forms of contact, there's multiple lines of contact that are going to drive a nuanced deployment of your forces. You know, we have this unmanned contact zone where we know we're going to just use cover and concealment to try to hide our formations, try to remain as survivable as we can while we generate combat power, whatever we're doing. We hit that first indirect fire line when we know the enemy is able to disrupt our formation with indirect fires. Now we've essentially speed is security at that point. We're really maximizing the use of those strike platform. We hit another line where we know AT systems. At that point, we hit that line. That line up until you're deploying for actions on the objective, there is this kind of gray period where it's gray space where it's the art of fighting the striker brigade as a system and figuring out how you did that. And watching you guys do that was really kind of exciting because, again, you had the 30 millimeters, you had the Crow's Jay, how you either masked that, where you established support by fire, what echelon you did that at was all very, very interesting. I'm curious what your takeaway is. Hey, you have a time machine, you can go back. How would you kind of train or set your brigade up or your battalion up to learn that fight or just to kind of talk about that beforehand?
As you encounter out here the enemy, they're dispersed, right? In the attack, a lot of times what we saw is they're going to mass to penetrate. What I thought they were trying to do as we continually assessed it was degrade and slow us down over time to give themselves time to reorient, to put themselves in the positions they wanted to. And so now you run into that mental model of, oh, well, then I just got to clear this with my dismounts. Well, that's great. Not when it's 14 kilometers of mountains. It's 14 kilometers of mountains. That's an all-night fight, and you're still not at the objective yet. And now you're like, all right, well, we just walked 14 kilometers and fought our way through like a handful of OPs and a smattering of BRDMs and whatnot. Now we have to seize the objective. And it's like, whew, right. This is going to be a slog.
As we're kind of running low on time, one of the things I really want to talk about, because this is Army in transformation. You know, we are changing the organization, but you did not have a cavalry squadron assigned as part of the Striker Brigade. What did that do for you? How did that impact your operation?
When the Army made the decision, hey, we're going to take away cavalry squadrons, we're going to fill that with division assets and unmanned systems, et cetera. My initial thought was, that makes sense. I saw 24 rotations, usually the cav squadron, you know, took two cav squadrons to accomplish what we needed to forward, and then the infantry was able to go do its thing. What I have found, as you talk about that open phasing, right, where we just did not stop the entire time. One, I would tell anyone listening, like, sleep now, because you won't sleep. For 10 days, no matter how much your OCTs ask you to, like, you just simply can't, because you're constantly in contact of some kind. And so what the cav squadron used to give us that we don't yet, I think, have an answer for is who is doing that consistent contact with the enemy that's now not just the ones who are supposed to seize the objective. So the cav squadron's fighting for information, they're confirming PIR, they're out there, you know, maintaining consistent contact, not allowing the enemy to reorient itself, not allowing them to fall back to where they want to establish an even more robust defense. What we found is we could not maintain that contact enough with our fighting formations, having no cav squadron also being detrimented in our other infantry battalion for this rotation. The two infantry battalions, to try to maintain that contact to keep the enemy from repositioning itself, really created a problem, especially the first half of the rotation, for the S2 to tell us like what we were fighting. We didn't know. Because every time we would get to where we thought we were going to fight something, we would fight something, but it wasn't what we thought. And it's like, well, where the heck did these guys go? Mm-hmm. Well, we weren't able to maintain the contact with them consistent, you know, enough to be able to keep them where we wanted so we could kill them where we had a clear understanding of what echelon we were up against. So not having that, what we've tried to do, I think we'll go back and we'll relook at it as a brigade. We had, you know, two scout platoons with some UAS systems. I think if that scout platoon is really trained really well, they can go out and they can answer some things for you.
Sure.
They can see things, they can report things, they can do a little bit of shaping. They're not going to maintain the consistent contact with the enemy that a cav squadron was able to. They're just simply not large enough. An answer would be, how are we going to do that in the future as we talk about transformation and what we're going to put into striker brigades to fill that gap, whether it's, you know, more robust UAS, whether it's multifunctional reconnaissance company. Yeah, hey, who's the commander for it?
Sure.
what's the training for, look like for that now only one company? But that company can still do more than one platoon can.
Sure.
So we definitely struggled with that throughout, and that our scout platoons, the expansive largeness of the desert, scout platoon loses one team, that's a mass scout for the scout platoon.
Sure.
That's one of your four strikers down. Okay, like how much further can you go at that point? Well, it depends. You either leave them there and be like, sorry, bud, we're going to keep pushing forward, or we're going to fight this with the three that we got left. So it's definitely a capability gap that we have. And that's one of those when we talk about what can we do right now, what can we do in the future? That's one that we've already put a pin in, is we need to sit down when we get back and figure out at least at 2-2, what can we do so that we can start training, so that we put that training glide path together for whether we make that company or we still fight at a scout. But how is an organizational system, do we feed to the battalion and the brigade the information that that reconnaissance used to provide? It's not going to provide you security. That security now, the way that we've done it is I assign that to a company. Like, you have my security zone. So as you talk about persistent contact and constantly be like, well, that company may have just seized an objective and now I need you to continue to maintain some contact with that enemy. And when do they culminate at that point? So when we talk transition, that was a big thing for me coming in, was talking transitions, because it's what I saw here in the old, you know, with Sobe periods. It kind of gave you an opportunity to transition a little bit, you know, at least think about it. This does not, which I think is fantastic. You know, I would love a Sobe here and there. I think what it does is it forces you to truly think 2, 3, 4 steps ahead every single day, multiple times. You can never be satisfied with where you are. Because as soon as you're like, all right, I've got my objective, I'm good, what's our next mission going to be? No, your mission just doesn't end.
Right.
How do I F-pull the next company forward? How do I continue to leapfrog so I can maintain that contact? It's where we're at right now. So we just got to figure out how to solve that problem.
I could talk to you all day. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate it. For the listeners, I think you've given some things to think about, particularly if you're coming here, and how do you standardize some of the things? It's really kind of a cognitive offloading. Figure out known points on as many things as you possibly can. This is how Tomahawk Battalion fights. And we'll start from a known point and we can adjust from there. Those are great lessons. And I really appreciate the discussion. It was a real pleasure to watch you and the Lancer Brigade come here and fight. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I really appreciate your insights.
Thanks,
and best of luck in the rest of your regeneration and travel back to JBL.
I appreciate it, sir. You have a fantastic team. I would tell everyone, if you're ever worried about coming out here and working with the OCTs, do not. Like, you will not find a more professional group of people. So humbling to be able to be asked to be here. We had a great time, learned way more than I wanted to, but we're leaving significantly better than when we got here. So thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And I invite you to look at our latest products online. Subscribe to our TAC Talks on YouTube for quick hitting lessons. Thanks for listening to Thinking Inside the Box, The Gauntlet, part of the Warrior Chronicles here at the National Training Center. Train the force.